Welcome to Warships Pod, and my guest for this episode is Dr. Helen Fry, the author of more than 25 books on the social history of World War II, not least British intelligence activities, spies and the like. She is a leading authority on many related topics, including on the so-called secret listeners, who eavesdropped on what enemy prisoners of war were discussing in order to gain insights into what was going on in the enemy's war effort, and also the mindset of the foe. Among Helen's books are Women in Intelligence, The Wolves Have Ears, and The London Cage. Welcome, Helen.
Thank you. It's great to be on the podcast.
And before we jump into a discussion of your area of expertise, teasing out naval angles here and there, can I ask, how did you get into this fascinating area of writing? What's your road been to here?
Well, I always think it's accidental, although my publisher thinks otherwise. I think it's the way I just research. But I started some 20, 25 years ago, and I was looking at the stories of 10,000 Germans and Austrians who fought for Britain. Around 90% of them were Jewish, and around 10% anti-Nazis. And of course, by the middle of the war, they're not just digging for victory in the British Army. They're actually being taken up for intelligence duties. They're fighting behind enemy lines. And that's really how I fell into the field of intelligence. And now I'm there. I'm gonna stay there because I'm loving it. I'm loving the uncovering of all those, that secret war that continues to inspire the public.
And do you find that, talking of digging for victory, but digging for new facts and interesting angles, do you find that there's still some amazing stuff out there to be found even now?
Oh, absolutely. There are always files being declassified from all kinds of departments, War Office, whether it's Foreign Office, Air Intelligence, Naval Intelligence, you know, whole raft. Sometimes it gets quietly slipped into the archives because I guess there's so much being declassified. A bit trickier for MI6 because they never release their files, and MI5 release some now and again. So it's always important to look. And the files that I used for Women in Intelligence, much of that hadn't been declassified when I started 25 years ago. So it's a gradual journey uncovering some fascinating stories and sometimes not realizing that there is a book to be written on a particular area until you get way down the line several years later and you suddenly think, my goodness, we've got to tell these stories.
Yeah, I agree. And do you find that they're not made open to the public, the ones that are still classified? I'm quite surprised that even 25 years ago that some were still secret. So is there any particular reason why they don't open some of the files up even now?
Well, a lot of the SOE files are only just coming out now, the Special Operations Executive, a lot of the personal files. And that has to do with the fact that veterans could still be alive and data protection. Some of it has to do with secrecy. Potentially, one of the reasons given is that certain modes of operation might still be being used in the field, in intelligence. But, you know, it's hard to see that now in a technological age. And I think we have moved on so much further. But yeah, you know, I often get asked that question, why are files classified? Don't they come out after 50 years, 100 years? And the answer is no. The intelligence services are not subject to the Freedom of Information Act. So they're exempt. It means we cannot put in a Freedom of Information request. I also discovered that Special Branch is another one of the Metropolitan Police. Hence, you can't get the Jack the Ripper files, which are well over 100 years old now. And some royal stuff still, sensitivities that we probably don't really understand, but for some reason they're deemed sensitive and they have to be held back. And I think as historians we have to respect that. There's plenty of stuff for us to work on, not to worry about that for the time being.
And people will be surprised that maybe the ones that are not familiar with your work or other people's work, that actually one key way of finding out about the enemy, what the enemy thought and what they were up to was actually eavesdropping. And by that, of course, we don't mean just standing by the window under the eaves and listening to what somebody's saying in a room, but they used it during the Second World War. And can you explain to us how that was done and maybe touch on a few naval angles?
Yes. I mean, this has turned out to be one of the longest deceptions and intelligence operations alongside Bletchley Park and the code breaking of the Second World War. And there was no precedent for this. This was started by a wartime commander who later became Colonel Thomas Kendrick. He'd spent nearly four decades in the end working for what today we call MI6. But in the Second World War, he begins this operation to gain intelligence from German prisoners of war and some Italians too. And eventually, after 1942, we start capturing Hitler's top commanders, his generals and field marshals, and right the way through to the end of the war. And we knew, or he knew, that if you gave them a phony interrogation, I mean, they're not going to give up anything in interrogation, particularly at the early part of the war. So if you give them a phony interrogation, they go back to their room, and they were often held in three stately homes outside London, and people can read about that in The Walls Have Ears. I mean, very, very clever. And they go back and they start boasting to their mate who'd been captured with them what they hadn't told the interrogating officer. And quite often they would hold U-boat crew with a shot down Air Force, German Air Force pilot, so that they would compare their war. And it's really clever, because the prisoners' conversations, when they were held in these three sites, they were bugged for the moment they woke up until when they went to sleep at night. So we were getting tons and tons of information right across the wartime. And in terms of the intelligence on the naval stuff, it's huge. We are getting, with the earliest intelligence, we started in the Tower of London, the earliest intelligence is from U-boat crew that are captured. And it looks like, I've started to make a list, every single U-boat that was sunk in the war and had survivors, it looks like those survivors came through Kendrick's three sites. And they will run air, naval and army intelligence. So all that tri-services operation. And they gave up a lot of information on new technology being used by the German Navy. They gave up stuff on U-boat technology, battleships. We captured a lot of the crews from battleships, major ones like the Scharnhorst. And, you know, gradually we're getting a picture of the Battle of the Atlantic, and somebody needs to write a book on the impact of this intelligence across, you know, 5 years on the Battle of the Atlantic and the war at sea. It's huge.
Well, that might be you then, I suppose. I mean, you're already digging into it. So are you volunteering?
I'm not volunteering at the moment. I'm not a naval historian. I think it needs to be a really specialist naval historian. And I just think it's incredible when you think that pretty much every single U-boat that was sunk, its survivors came through these secret sites, and they're all giving up stuff to the hidden microphones. And somebody needs to do a dedicated effort to go through that and see the kind of stuff that they're giving up. And they do give up material that enabled Bletchley Park to crack Naval Enigma in the early part of 1940. And I mean, I could talk in more detail about that if you're interested.
Yeah, I mean, I know what you're talking about, because I've read quite a few of the interrogation reports of the U-boat survivors. Yeah. And it always made me laugh in a way how much stuff they gave up, and the variety of it, you know, into the character and the personality of their captains, and also various other things that were going on all right across the Navy, as you say. But I think before we get into Enigma and things like that, and maybe that comparison you're talking about, what I'd like to ask is how did they do the eavesdropping? Did they put microphones in the wall? Did they put it in the overhead lights? How did they do that?
Yeah, so the microphones were embedded in, well, they were hidden in light fittings and in fireplaces. The wiring was deeply embedded in the walls and behind skirting boards. Some of the later hurried operations, when more of the generals were coming, they did another lot of wiring of the house, Trent Park, near Cockfosters in North London. And that was all hurried wiring under the floorboards. And they put microphones behind the mirrors, in plant pots, in billiards tables. I mean, absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. It's very kind of 007 and sort of Johnny English almost, I suppose. But so the big thing that gets a lot of attention, though, is the capture by the Navy, and I guess there were other captures as well, and gifts of Naval Enigma machines and code books. And then was the breaking of the codes, because you mentioned Bletchley Park, GCHQ, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
It had a different name then, didn't it? So what level of success was achieved to assist in that by the eavesdropping? I mean, you mentioned it a second ago, but I mean, did it really boost it in that they knew how to go about cracking the ciphers?
Well, this is the extraordinary thing. When I started out on the research, I had no idea what was going to be uncovered. Absolutely no idea. And if you look at January 1940, and I always remember the date, it's the 8th of January 1940, already one of the crew, Erich May, who's a telegraphist, they knew quite a bit about Naval Enigma. And just as New Year breaks, Kendrick's unit is actually, there's a flurry of activity between his teams, his naval intelligence teams, and Bletchley Park. And then on the 8th of January, Erich May extraordinarily hand draws how Naval Enigma works. Because essentially, he'd been taken out by Lieutenant Purnell, one of our naval interrogators. And Purnell had taken him out for a nice lunch, and he'd gone from the Tower of London, actually, had a lovely lunch, and he'd gone back to his colleagues and said, you know, the British, they're so hospitable and such a nice man, etc. But Purnell had started to boast to Erich May, you think you've broken the British naval codes? Well, actually, it's a deception. Our codes are totally secure. They're unbreakable. And Erich May says, no, that can't possibly be. No, the German codes are unbreakable. This is how they work. And that's the hand drawing of the 8th of January 1940. And I photographed it because I thought, well, number one, I didn't believe my eyes. And Number two, I didn't believe anyone else would believe me.
No.
So it's extraordinary. And there he gives up so much. And then I cross-referenced with the official Bletchley Park history, which is in the National Archives. And there it says that Bletchley was able to break the Naval Enigma code because of the intelligence given up by this prisoner at this site. I mean, amazing that no one had joined up those dots before. And so that began to be an amazing discovery, actually, of this research. And there's still so much more that can be uncovered by historians.
And do you know, I mean, you say he drew it. So did they get that off him? How did they get that off him? Did they sneak into his cell at the Tower of London and photograph it? Or did they somehow persuade him to give it up? I mean, how did they get that drawing?
No, he actually, so they write up a report and he actually sits down with Lieutenant Purnell and actually hand draws it in front of him.
Ah, right.
So this is how it works. I mean, extraordinary, really extraordinary.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't actually understand it because I'm not very good at technology, but I knew that this was quite a find, and there are a number of writings around that date, and he becomes one of the key, well, the most valuable prisoners at that time. I mean, who would have believed that it was just something so simple as that? So that was one instance where it wasn't given up to hidden microphones. That was a case that the judgment was made that if we befriended him, and, you know, none of this roughing up an interrogation, it's against the Geneva Convention and it doesn't produce reliable results. If we can assess particular prisoners, and it happened throughout the wartime, and particularly with Hitler's generals, if we can befriend them, then, you know, maybe we could get the intelligence that way. And of course, the hidden microphones were the other layer. And they also used stool pigeons, which in the early days were our officers dressed up, well, either in naval uniform or as a Luftwaffe pilot. And it worked.
Right. And so I gather I did a book on submarine warfare, which, not in the detail you look into it, obviously, but looked into the naval intelligence side a little bit, and also the interrogation reports, but and other aspects. And I believe one of the things that the German prisoners would try to do, I think I've got this right, would they try to sneak information into their letters home, indicating, you know, how they were doing, or, I mean, hopefully I've got this the right way around, to their families in Germany with messages to pass on. I know the British did it. So somebody like Eric May, if he'd drawn that Enigma machine or whatever it was, then would he have realised he made a mistake and not mention it or try and mention it in any coded letters? Did they do coded letters home to try and give away things?
I mean, that was one of the things that struck me. Why did he do it? He must have so got the, you know, it's partly boasting and sort of egotistic view. But yeah, I still am puzzled by the fact that Eric May gave this up. And he's not the only example of that. But yes, we do have examples of where they sent coded messages. So we've got one example that's given in the archives, in this whole body of archives, in the War Office archives. In one case, and this was from Trent Park, one of the prisoners was looking out of the window and could see down the far end of the site near the lake, there was a shooting range, and there were quite often guards there, and, you know, you just look out and see somebody, men in uniform. But at one point, some of the guards were saying to the women in their lunch break, the ATS girls, oh, would you like to learn to shoot in your lunch break? And they thought, well, that's rather fun. So, of course, this prisoner looks out the window, sees the women practicing target, and one of them sends a coded message back to Germany, and we let it go through. And it said to Berlin, Churchill is training the women to fight. And, of course, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Yeah,
that's
well, that
a good
one.
One.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. So with the U-boat survivors, let's say one's sunk in the Western Approaches and they get out of a crew of 40, yeah. 20 people. Some of them are officers. Some of them are ratings, as we call them in the Royal Navy. Where would they be split up and where would they go? I mean, you've mentioned a few places there, but did they sort of stream them to certain places to see what they could squeeze out of them?
They did. So they wouldn't necessarily split them up. We have to look at individual cases to know. But there were a number of, well, it's not a very nice word, but they're called cages. Cages, slang for interrogation centres, so, or camps. So they would use like Kempton Park in Surrey, Ascot. Well, there was one near Devizes, which later was run by the Americans primarily. And the prisoners were kind of siphoned through those sites. And sometimes, particularly after D-Day, there were thousands of them going through these sites, were assessing where they've come from. Doesn't matter on their rank, because whatever their rank, they might still have valuable intelligence, depending on where they've been picked up, what action they might have seen. And if it's off a particular U-boat, we'll already have been tracking and we'll know, you know, what its action has been. And if they're very, very valuable, sometimes they were interrogated in like Kempton Park, but quite often they were transferred to one of Kendrick's three sites. So Trent Park and the two others were Latham House and Wilton Park in Buckinghamshire. And that's where they would go through this, well, either the sort of charm offensive, but also this kind of phony interrogation, rather relaxed. The prisoners thought we were stupid and incompetent. You know, the British don't know how to interrogate. I mean, we would never interrogate. Like, you know, they just thought it was a bit Dad's Army. They just thought we were totally, well, a bit bonkers. And then they go back to the room with their mate and, or the cell. There were cells that they were only kept in for a few days at Latimer House and Wilson Park. And they would give up intelligence to those hidden microphones. We knew exactly what we were doing. It was so clever. And then after they'd given up pretty much everything, a few days later, we think, okay, he's repeating himself. He's talking about his wife and kids. Move him on to a regular prisoner of war camp where they were not bugged. They did not have microphones and they were quite often working the land or doing forestry work and that kind of thing.
And so when they were working the land and doing their forestry work, would there be, there wouldn't be any attempt to put undercover people alongside them who pretended to be Germans or, you know, local farm workers or whatever who were helping them? Did they leave them alone then in that respect too?
They did. We don't have any evidence that they carried on the intelligence side after they'd left Kendrick's sites. I mean, if you think about the volume of prisoners that are going through, I mean, you know, July, August, 1944, you think about the captures after D-Day immediately, but July, August, the figures are huge. In one case, you know, we've got sort of 70 to 80,000 prisoners being captured within a very short space of time, just within days and across the month. And that's compounding. They've all got to be dealt with really, really quickly through those different cages. And there were a number of others around the country. I believe it was started off with about 8 and then up to about 12. So this is separate from Kendrick's secret sites. So it's an industrial scale intelligence gathering operation. There's no room to be slow and just taking your time. But the other thing, of course, is that if you wait too long, it becomes old intelligence. So it's a huge operation. It's working 24/7. Every day of the week, every day of the year. I mean, that for me is extraordinary part of this. And we are gathering tons and tons of intelligence.
And I think the thing that also amazes me, and which you obviously are well into and you've investigated and written books about, is the fact that the intelligence gathering operation, as you said, it was massive, and 1944 was dealing with industrial scale levels of prisoners to process, but across the war it was very multi-layered, wasn't it? And it was about Enigma, but there's also a lot of human intelligence. You know, in the U-boat bases, there'd be people in the resistance or whatever feeding information, and the interrogations you talk about there. But do you think the obsession with Bletchley Park and Enigma and the achievements of certain notable men, famous men there, Alan Turing and others, has it done a disservice to the women who toiled away across the various other areas of intelligence gathering and even at Bletchley Park? Do you think it's put them in the shadow rather unjustly?
Well, it's a difficult one because, you know, it's taken time for this material to come out. If we're thinking about the eavesdropping program, that didn't come out until decades after Bletchley Park, at least two, nearly three decades. So that was held back partly because, well, I'm pretty sure it's because of the Cold War. And so when the Berlin Wall comes down, by, you know, the late 1990s, someone in the MOD is, well, okay, we can start declassifying this stuff. So it takes the War Office or MOD, Ministry of Defence, nearly 5 years for someone to go through all of these files relating to Kendrick's operation and check there's nothing still sensitive. And this is a good 20, 25 years after the first stuff comes out about Bletchley Park. And the media, of course, do play a part. They get excited about certain stories and they run with it, and then everybody runs with it. And I think, you know, just beavering away, being able to tell the stories that we can tell when we can. Don't forget also that the men and the women had all signed the Official Secrets Act. And even with those files being declassified, I still took time. It still sometimes took me a few years for veterans to finally open up and talk. And I physically had to show them photocopies of some of the files. And they were still then very reticent because of the Official Secrets Act.
That's incredible, though, isn't it? All that time since the Second World War, and they were still really, really, really worried about it. So when you went to see them, did it take a number of hours to get them to divulge the stuff and relax and, you know, a cup of tea and a bit of a chat before they did that? Did you have to? You were almost kind of charming them and interrogating them a little bit like the people during the war with the German prisoners of war. I mean, did you have to become practiced in teasing this information out of them in a nice way?
No, it was more, well, if we're talking about the secret listeners and they were at the eavesdropping sites, they were largely, primarily German Jewish or Austrian Jewish refugees. One of them, Fritz Lustig, I'd known him for a number of years. And as I started at the beginning, I was telling the stories of veterans, 10,000 Germans that fought for Britain, and I mean Austrians as well. Very difficult to get the stories of the women way back then, 20 years ago, because when I made appeals in newspapers and various key places, refugee journals and that kind of thing, they didn't think they'd done anything special. That actually turned out not to be true when you finally did get to meet them. So the men then also were very, very reluctant to talk about their war, a lot of trauma in their past, multiple layers of trauma. And I became friends and I said, well, can't you tell me about your training in North Devon when you're training in the British Army? They were way up there on the coast. Oh, yes. And that was quite safe. And then they go on to do other things. So it actually took years to even discover that, for example, they didn't stay in the British Army's Pioneer Corps, so-called Digging for Victory, for more than 3 years. And that they did something else. So when they trusted me 2 or 3 years down the line, and they would invite me to their veteran reunions and their coffee mornings. And then suddenly Fritz Lustig said to me, and I'd written a few books by this point about their different stories. He said, but I never got a chance to fight on the front line. And that's what I wanted to do. I was a secret listener. I was in the Buckinghamshire countryside, stuck with these headphones on. And had anyone... You know, does anyone know what we did? Do we know? Did we do anything that made any difference to the outcome of the war? We know about the code breakers, but what about us? What about the secret listeners? And I promised him I would tell him, you know, I would look at the declassified files, because by 2004, they were all out, which is when he was first mentioning this to me. And we had no idea. He had no idea. He remembered when the prisoners of the Scharnhorst, that sort of Christmas, early year of 1943, they came through Latimer House. And he remembers V weapon intelligence, just snippets. You can't remember 3 years of what you're listening to on headphones. And okay, so you've got that. He's got these key topics. But then he says, well, did it make any difference? What are we over here? Were we just doing this? What happened to the intelligence that we gathered? And so it's been this long, slow discovery of research where I've done most of the digging, which has been great fun, and doing the analytical work, giving talks all over the place, people coming out of the woodwork. My mother did such and such. I've suddenly found her photograph in your book. And so we've got a second edition of various books as a result of the drilled down, detailed research. So it's taken a very, very long time, and there are still families of the men and women, the intelligence staff across 3 services, that still don't know. Their relatives are in some of the photographs, group photographs in my book. And that's how it is. And the families have also gone on this journey to discover what their mothers, uncles, whatever, have done at these secret sites. So that's how it's been. It's been a long, slow journey, and nobody knew when we started out. We couldn't ever have predicted that it would be this long journey and such fun as well, and that we would discover categorically they did produce war-winning intelligence from these sites, and that's actually been acknowledged by Historic England.
Oh, that's fantastic. I mean, that's really great that you did that. And I suppose by 2004, you really were in a race against time to get the veterans. I call them veterans. They were veterans, obviously. I'm not sure. Do you call intelligence people in the intelligence service veterans? I mean, were they uniformed? They were all uniformed, were they? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. They were all uniformed in the intelligence corps. I interviewed a 101-year-old woman who was an officer in naval intelligence who'd been recruited by Ian Fleming, actually, and she was serving at Latimer House. Yes, they were all in uniform. I didn't come across any civilians. And in the Admiralty, of course, and in naval intelligence, because a lot of the women had been taken up in uniform already were elsewhere, they had to start looking, bringing in civilians who then didn't serve in uniform. And the same was true when Travis at Bletchley Park wanted to increase the number of women. He found that so many of them had enlisted in the services and were already serving elsewhere. He had to start recruiting women, but they didn't always serve in uniform. And so, yeah, that's the way it was.
So you mentioned, and I must just go back on that because people listening will want me to do this, even though I think he's a bit done to death in the history of World War II and intelligence. What did your contact, your interviewee that worked with Ian Fleming think to him? Did she puncture any myths?
She didn't actually. She just said we were recruited by Ian Fleming, and she's in a photograph outside Latimer House, 1943, and Fleming is in that photograph. It's not a very flattering one of him, but he was training his 30 assault unit not far away in Amersham. So this is, of course, yeah, there in Buckinghamshire. And she doesn't say anything about him actually, but she does talk, because I was interested in what she did. And this is when the Naval Intelligence started to do things on the basis of ability. And that's something I discovered across the intelligence services, that they start to, well, they use people irrespective of gender. And this woman, Evelyn Barron, said to me, we did something very unusual for a woman. And I thought I knew what she was going to say. I thought they were doing some analysis, which some of the air intelligence women had been doing at Latimer. And she said, no, we were the interrogators. And so I think Fleming was behind that as well, instigating the whole use. And they were the first and only known female interrogators in uniform in the early part of the war. I found some since and later in the war. But this was, I think, pretty much groundbreaking research and something I could never have imagined. And it was as a result of that interview, and I came away with that, and many people said to me, oh, Helen, she can't possibly, no, she's not an interrogator, she's 101, you know, it's her memory. Hugely insulting, actually, for you know, to veterans. And I thought, I'm not having this. It happened quite a lot. And I trudged through those thick volumes of naval intelligence files. Whenever I had a moment at the archives, a spare moment, it took me a long time, but I finally found the cluster of, well, her and her colleagues. And there next to her name, it says interrogator.
So did they decide that they would use female interrogators? Was that with women prisoners, or was that to put male prisoners, like say some crusty old commodore in the German Navy or a general who would be kind of put off balance by having to or charmed by a woman? What was the thinking there, do you think? To I know ability was important, but was there another reason in that they wanted to kind of undermine them in some way with their own perspective on being faced with a woman, do you think?
Absolutely. It's all about the psychology. And, you know, we didn't, as far as we can tell, haven't found a single woman who was interrogated, or even a phony interrogation, at any of Kendrick's sites. So they were all male. The idea was that, you know, you got your couple of prisoners are kind of waiting in their respective rooms to be interrogated. They're thinking in their mind about how interrogation would happen in Germany, and they're kind of getting psychologically toughened up for this. And they're expecting two men to walk in, and in walk two women. And it completely throws them. I mean, Evelyn Barron said to me, she said, there's this little glint in her eye, she said, it completely threw them. And it was kind of over. The interrogation was over. They didn't know how to behave. Later, when one of the air intelligence women interrogated Adolf Galland, Hitler's ace pilot, he did start to flirt with her. He's a young sort of 21-year-old, 22-year-old. I mean, what's the British thing? They're using young women as interrogators. They just thought we'd run out of, you know, experienced, skilled interrogators. But they're also thinking in their mind, in Germany, there could have been a bit of the rough treatment, but we didn't do that at these sites. And the use of women, I think, was so clever, but they were found to be good at it, and they had a good memory because they wouldn't interrogate just once. They could repeatedly interrogate the same prisoners, and they had a fantastic memory for detail. And if the story wasn't quite right.
Yeah. And she was in the Navy, was she? Naval Intelligence, that lady. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Brilliant. So I suppose that is a very clever way of doing it. I mean, I don't know if I was one of those Germans and I was expecting some rough treatment and you know, a couple of hairy men across the table and a woman came in, I'd be suspicious, you know, I'd be worried. But I suppose their egos, you know, yeah, got the better of them, hopefully. Yeah. Oh, brilliant. And you have already mentioned the fact that you've done extensive research and books about the Jewish soldiers. I mean, did any of them serve in the Navy at all, the people?
Yes, there were around 25 of them.
Yeah.
the Royal Navy was very sort of British, as though one of them I interviewed, Bill Howard, that was his anglicised name. He was Adolf Hirschberg originally. And yes, he's not going to keep that. But yeah, they were taken up to, in his case, they've given special code books from Bletchley Park, but he was listening into surface shipping. And he actually located at one point the location in 44 of the Tirpitz. And he said, well, you know, it wasn't very long afterwards, they heard the hell of a noise and it was blown out of the water. Now, I haven't done further research and trace anymore on that, but there was a lot of suspicion about, you know, Germans in the Royal Navy. What do you want any Germans for? But of course, they proved their worth and, yeah, made their own contribution, but there were only a small handful, around 25 of them.
And your new book, it's coming out soon, is called Why I Became an Ex-Troop Commando. And although that's about someone who served with distinction in what was a British Army unit, Army commandos, though, did those men get their feet wet for, you know, to help out with Allied invasions? Did they get engaged in amphibious operations at all?
Yes, absolutely. So in Colin's case, he was originally Klaus Ascher, and he became Colin Anson, changed his name. He was part of X-Troop. X-Troop was totally made up. One or two exceptions, there was a Hungarian in there and a couple of other nationalities, but they were primarily German or Austrian, but mostly Germans. And they didn't serve together. They were the only troop that didn't stay together in action. They were sent off in twos or threes to other units. In Colin's case, he was with Number 40 Commando, and he was involved in the landings in Sicily and Italy. And then later, so he sustained a life-threatening head injury. It was a very dramatic part of his story. And 9 months later, when he dies on the operating theatre, and they revive him, and he does survive. 9 months later, recuperating, he wants to go back and fight. And they're going, no, we're going to send you back to London and you can do a desk job. And he's got this kind of band of brothers, this very, you know, close relationship with his comrades. They were like brothers. And he said, no, I want to go back with my unit. And he then has operations on the Yugoslav islands of Brach, Hvar, and then he's involved in the liberation of Corfu. But before that, he's involved in operations with Number 2 Brigade in Albania. That was tough. Really tough. They were living behind enemy lines, you know, really close to the wire for 2 to 3 weeks. And it was like a monsoon rain weather. They couldn't continue their operations. They just had to, once they'd landed, they just had to hide for 2 or 3 weeks in ravines and, you know, crevices. I mean, incredible story. But that he said to me, as so many of them did, this was our war. We'd lost the land of our birth. This was our war. It was for us to fight Hitler. We were not going to sit back and let everyone else do it. And that's, it's utter determination to fight and not to safely stay in England.
So Colin, 40 Commando is a Royal Marine unit. Mm. So he was working with the Royal Marines, which is a great angle for this podcast, obviously, because we include the Royal Marines are part of the Navy. So Colin's background, so it'd be interesting to know. I mean, was he was a teenager, was he, in Germany? He was a young lad before he had to flee?
He fled at the age of 17. So he comes out, he's sort of attached to the Kindertransport, although Kindertransport, they had to be under 16. But he had a sort of working farm permit, and they kind of attached him to one of the last transports, the Kindertransports, out of Germany. He was at risk. His mother was Protestant. She stayed and lived through the war, through the bombings and everything in Frankfurt. His father was Jewish, and his father died in Dachau in 1937 for trying to get up. He was very politically influential, and he tried to get up an anti-Nazi party against Hitler. He was very outspoken, and he was betrayed. I won't give away the ending of what happens when Colin discovers the betrayer. But yeah, Colin was at risk. because he not only had a Jewish father, but he had a father who was vocal against, very vocal against the Nazi regime, for which he'd paid for his life. So Colin comes to England, works on a farm not far from Oxford, it's actually Wallingford, and then he enlists in the British Army about a year after the outbreak of war as a so-called enemy alien. A horrible term, but that's how they were known then. They were of enemy nationality. You could not get British nationality unless you'd been here for 5 years. So some of the Freud family could if they'd come out of Berlin. So the Berlin side of the Freud family were naturalised British by the outbreak of war, whereas the Austrian side, and Sigmund Freud never got nationality because he died within a year or so of him coming to the UK. So they were enemy aliens. And so Colin was in the same situation, as were 10,000 Germans and Austrians. They could not get British nationality later, so they could not be conscripted. But it goes back to that feeling, you know, Colin said this was our war. We wanted to fight. And so they volunteered, and he did lose comrades on the battlefield, some of ex-troop in other operations, in D-Day landings. They died on those beaches. And it was said that apart from Bomber Command, they had the highest casualty fatality rate. And, you know, they were prepared to put their lives back on the line, and as so many of them told me, to fight for the country that had saved us. We wanted to give something back to Britain for saving our lives. So it's that two strand, and that was very much through Colin's life. And he served originally in the Pioneer Corps. And then when this kind of mysterious man called a Mr. Hartman, I remember that was his real name, would move around and live for a few days with various companies of the Pioneer Corps, try to ascertain whether they were up for anything else. And that's how some of them got recruited for the Special Operations Executive, but also for this new troop that was being formed called X Troop. And they trained in Aberdovey in West Wales. And of course, they trained in Scotland. They were up and down Scotland, but their base was in Aberdovey in West Wales. And there is a wonderful memorial to them in Aberdovey.
All right. I've never been there. I've been to a few others, but I didn't know that was there in Wales. And the Pioneer Corps, just so the listeners understand this, the people are not familiar with it, they were digging ditches, weren't they? They were going around helping with the infrastructure of Britain, weren't they? So that was a fairly, I suppose, for somebody who wanted to fight like Colin and other people, would be a pretty disgruntling or boring occupation, wouldn't it? So that would enhance their desire to go and fight.
It was, and they saw this as I said, their war. They thought they were wasted in the Pioneer Corps because they were, you know, building Nissen huts, forestry work. In some cases, they were actually guarding the docks, Pembroke docks, for example. Some of them were clearing bomb damage in South London in the 1940-41. And this was not their idea of fighting Hitler. And so when they had the opportunity, the government kind of woke up by the middle of the war around 42 was when we get the special stuff, the Special Operations Executive, the Germans and Austrians being able to transfer into commando units, small-scale raiding forces, all that kind of thing. And then from 1943, the government opened up for all areas, although the Royal Navy was amongst the last to accept. But again, the Royal Air Force was very difficult to get in if you weren't British. We had one veteran who was the only German fighter pilot, known fighter pilot in the RAF. And that's because he was courting the colonel's daughter. The colonel sent him as far away as possible from his daughter.
That's one way of getting into the RAF, I suppose.
It was very difficult to get into the RAF and certainly to become a pilot. They couldn't. They were mainly doing the mechanical stuff. But yeah, the government wake up and think, hang on, we've got native German speakers. What about intelligence operations? Hence, the secret listeners start being taken on in the middle of 1943. And all this is going on. It's just an insight into the incredible contribution that they made, of which Colin was one of around 102, of roughly 102 members in X Troop.
Right, so X Troop, your book's on Colin, but and looking across your books, in fact, this year being the 80th anniversary of D-Day, June 6th, 1944, landings in Normandy. Have you touched on elements of that preparation for it, intelligence gathering or anything else connected with the D-Day invasion, the Normandy landings at all across your books?
I have, and in Women in Intelligence, I've got some fascinating new material on naval intelligence. You know, it's a shame that so many historians don't focus on naval intelligence. But if you look through the files, and particularly the personnel, the list of personnel, it gives names them, but also what they're doing in various departments. And the women are deeply embedded there, not only as typists and clerks, but they're actually doing, and they are heads of section, and they're doing intelligence work proper. So one example at the Citadel, there's a section that's actually in charge of the whole of the intelligence picture for the, so the geographically they're dividing up areas, and there's the whole area where the D-Day landings are going to take place in Normandy. And that section, Section K, was headed by a Miss Lee. Now, we think she was civilian and not necessarily in uniform, but she is listed in and was part of naval intelligence. And for me, that upturns everything, all our assumptions about what women could do, were doing. And she wasn't unique in heading up sections of naval intelligence because of her expertise. And it, for me, it's just mind-blowing to think, and so completely hidden. I discovered it accidentally. I was thumbing through some stuff and read this and thought, oh wow, she's in charge of the whole intelligence picture for the Admiralty for the D-Day landings. That did blow my mind. But we still don't know very much about her, and I understand that our search is still going on in the background to see if we can get a photograph of her to find out more about her. But I'm so pleased we could at least put something about her in the Women in Intelligence book.
And the Citadel, where she was in charge of that section, which was an awesome responsibility. That you mean that bunker-like building on Horse Guards in London? Is that where you mean? There's the main centre of the Admiralty there in London, yeah?
Yes. And so many of the men and the women, of course, were working underground in very confined spaces. The work of some of the telly princesses, as they were known, and doing some of the ultra stuff from Room 29, there were the secret ladies who were also doing that kind of work in very cramped, crowded, they're typing out a lot of the intelligence reports. So the women are actually compiling them from a whole raft of data. They're not just typing up something that, you know, they're maybe a male head of section's given them. They're actually bringing the intelligence together and writing the reports, typing them up, that go to the various people within the Admiralty and maybe even beyond that need to know. So it's challenging circumstances. They have to turn this intelligence around. They quite often have to get it before the morning meetings, before at least 9 a.m. every morning. So some of them were working for long hours and even into the night. It got to the stage where a lot of the women working in naval intelligence actually had to sleep in one of the rooms there. You know, very, very challenging conditions. And they got quite fatigued, you know, mentally from all the analytical work, but also from this very hot, stuffy conditions, but they did amazing work.
So the work they were doing, obviously without intelligence, without accurate information and being able to know what was going on with the enemy, people would be killed. So they were presumably acutely aware lives were at risk when it came to timely intelligence.
I don't think it's just the women who were aware of this. I think all of those working in those crucial sections were aware of just how vital they were. They might not necessarily have the wider picture, like with Bletchley Park. Quite often people only knew what was going on in their hut. But I think certainly working in naval intelligence, they were aware. And when they're tracking the shipping, they've got this huge, it's often the women moving the ships around. So they've got to know the location of certain ships, U-boats. They are very aware of the responsibility and that, yeah, that lives are at stake.
And when you look across the scope of British intelligence, maybe today, just for comparison, when we've got artificial intelligence now, you know, a high-tech age, do you think that there's still a major role to be played by human beings to gain insights, to analyse things, to compile things, to actually play a key role in gleaning, you know, intelligence information that could perhaps be decisive? Are we still there with the human element in it all, do you think?
Well, I think it does have a part to play. Whether we still do that or are too reliant on technology, I don't know. I don't look at or have any knowledge of contemporary operations. I really only go into the early Cold War. But I think, yeah, why not? We can't totally be reliant on technology, and not just in the intelligence world or operationally. We've all become so reliant. And I think it is important that we keep developing our critical thinking, our analytical development, that we don't rely on a gadget to tell us how to get from A to B. So I'm hoping, just like the series on Netflix or Apple TV or on BBC, that there's wonderful spy dramas that we like and the police detective things, that yes, much of that is still being done. I like to think so.
Yeah, I think so as well. I think it's important in the age of the robots to have the human beings in there, you know, taking some of the decisions. Well, that's all been really, really fascinating stuff, Helen. And thank you very much for coming on to talk about this subject.
It's been great to chat to you today. Thanks.
Please check out the June edition of Warship Sci-Fi magazine for our D-Day 80 special. And it includes looking at history's biggest amphibious assault, the unsung heroes that showed the way to go, battleships in action, and also an iconic cruiser that almost took a king and a prime minister into action. And our June 2024 edition will be out on May the 17th. Connect with us via social media on X and Facebook, and in both cases that's at Warships IFR. And you can also find us on YouTube at Warships IFR TV. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your podcast app. Keep your eye on the horizon for our next episode.